I want to say two preliminary things. The first one is that to understand and enjoy the book of Proverbs, and indeed the Psalms and lots of other things, you've just got to understand one thing about Hebrew poetry. English poetry, we rhyme the sound. I mean, old-fashioned poetry anyway, not this sort of stuff that people write nowadays, but proper poetry, you rhyme the sound. So you could say something like, today the sun is very hot, and that's a handy rhyme for stot. Doesn't actually mean anything, but it's poetry because it rhymes. Hebrew poetry rhymes by the meaning. And so you get various forms of it, but simply, either the two halves of the verse sort of contradict each other, they're an antithesis, or as they complement each other, they support it. So you could get the sort of idea like the sun rises in the morning and in the evening it goes down. That's an antithesis. Rises in the morning, in the evening it goes down. Or you could say, the sun rises in the morning and sheds lights upon the people. In other words, you said the same thing, but twice. Now, in this passage of Proverbs, you've got marvellous antithetical poetry. The second half of each section nicely sort of contradicts or contrasts with the first. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son grief to his mother. Doesn't mean that a foolish son doesn't bring grief to his father as well. It's just a nice way of contrasting the two things. And that's actually the theme of the 14 verses. Wisdom and folly. So the first thing is it does help to understand that this is poetry and that instead of rhyming the sound, it's rhyming the sense by contrasting the first and the second half. The second thing I want to say is that in Jewish thought, wisdom and folly are not quite as we see them. And the most important thing to get in your mind is that to be a fool is not just a social problem, it is actually a sin. When Jesus is listing in Mark 7 all those evil things that come out of the human heart, he lists things like murder and theft and adultery, and in the middle of the list is folly. This sort of foolishness is just, oh, I made a bit of a fool of myself this morning, I ate my fish with the wrong knife. It's not like that. A fool is somebody who fundamentally has gone wrong. If you think back to the Garden of Eden, when human sin began, you've got that a picture of the woman being tempted by the fruit on the tree, and what is the decisive thing? She saw, I think they both saw, that it was desirable for gaining wisdom. They thought they could gain wisdom by disobeying God. And what they actually exhibited was the first primary initiatory act of folly of the human race. And subsequently we have reaped the dubious fruit of their folly all down through the centuries. Folly is disobeying God. So what is wisdom? Well, wisdom is obeying God, yes, wisdom is more than that. Wisdom is a godlike quality. Just as God is truth, just as God is love, just as God is beauty, God is wisdom. He's the source of all true knowledge. He's the clue to understanding anything and everything. And so if you turn your back on God, you've turned your back on wisdom. And no matter how clever you are, no matter how many problems you can solve, no matter how successful you are in business, you are, in the terms of the Bible, a fool. So folly is disobeying God, resisting his way. Wisdom is going God's way, opening yourself to his understanding, his explanation, his insight into what there is in life. So with those little remarks, let's look at the fool in these verses. It's a fairly awful catalogue of unpleasant things, and I'll rattle through it. In verse 1, the fool grieves his mother, thereby breaking the fourth commandment, honour your father and your mother. The fool dishonestly acquires wealth, thereby breaking the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. The fool craves for things, thereby breaking the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. The fool is idle. Well, I suppose you could say, if you're really scraping around, that that breaks the commandment that says you shall work for 6 days. I'm not sure that isn't cheating a bit. The Old Testament has a thing about idleness. It's not only the Old Testament. You remember Paul in Thessalonians as well. It means, of course, not enforced idleness, like when you can't work for whatever reason, but a person who prefers not to. They didn't think a lot of it. The fool is violent. Nobody actually knows exactly what the second half of verse 6 means, but it certainly means either that violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked, or that the mouth of the wicked conceals his violence. But anyway, violence is there. So the fool is a violent person, and how often that is actually true, lashing out in his folly. That therefore breaks the 5th commandment, thou shalt do no murder. So the picture of the fool here is of somebody who is indeed disobeying God, who's going his own way. And you'll see in verse 8, it's all sort of summed up. The wise in heart accept commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. The wise are prepared to accept commandments, instruction, guidance. The fool always thinks he knows. Now, it is an odd thing, isn't it, that when you meet somebody who you immediately think of as very wise, a really sagacious person, they actually listen to even the things that an idiot like I have to say. When you meet a fool, they know everything, don't they? There is that sort of person who even tells you about your own job. My future son-in-law is an architect, and the man next door is building an extension and asked his advice, but he couldn't get his advice in because the man knew exactly how he wanted to do it, including running the drain onto my son-in-law's back garden. But fools never think they need to learn anything. So the fool, and you can see it in verse 13, the fool lacks judgment. The fool is a chatterer, filling up his time with idle words. The fool is crooked, dishonest, hateful, violent. Now, that isn't our definition of folly. If you came here tonight thinking that you were going to hear a sermon about people who make you laugh, which is what fools usually do, that isn't laughable, is it? It's serious. Now, what's the clue to this Jewish understanding of folly? Well, it is the disobedience of commandments, but it's even more fundamental than that. Psalm 53, verse 1, has a quite categorical statement. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The summit of folly, the peak of folly, is when the fool decides God doesn't exist. And that is actually the secret of all folly. Because if there is no God, then everything is folly. You see, there is no cohesion in the universe. There is no point to anything. All is just absurd. And so you get, indeed, a philosophy that was very, very popular 10 or 15 years ago, that all of life is an absurdity. There is no point in taking it seriously. There's no point in worrying about it. It doesn't make any sort of sense. Do you remember those sort of plays, well, some of you aren't old enough, that we used to have on the television 15 years ago? Marvelously complicated intellectual plays, and just when you thought you might be getting the point of the play, the credits came up at the end. And what the writer was saying to you was, there is no point. That's what life's like. Doesn't make any sense at all. It's folly. It's ridiculous. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And if he's right, then all is indeed folly. And so, if you want to be foolish, if you want to be a fool, then dismiss the very idea of God, because that is the ultimate folly. Now, the other half of the poetry, of course, is the wise person. And what is the wise person? What are the marks of him? Well, of course, they're all opposites, because that's how you get the poetry, isn't it? In verse 1, the wise one respects his parents. A wise son brings joy to his father and his mother, presumably. You know, has a decent job and marries a sensible person and brings up 2.5 children and all the rest of it. I don't think that's what it means. He brings joy to his father by walking in the path that his parents would want him to walk in. He observes, he keeps the fourth commandment. He's straight and honest, verse 2. Righteousness is straightness, really, honesty. He enjoys God's favour. This is one of the difficulties, of course, about some of the Old Testament, this doctrine of inevitable retribution. The Lord doesn't let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. It's the idea, of course, that if you live God's way, God blesses you. If you go against it, then he heaps disasters on you, and that it all happens in this world. Now, I do know righteous people who for a short period of time have gone hungry, and I wouldn't be so bold as to say that there wasn't a righteous person in the world tonight who wasn't starving. It would be a very daring thing to say when one thinks of all the Christians who live in East Africa and Bangladesh and other countries where there's a great shortage of food. The principle that lies behind it, however, is absolutely basic to our understanding of God. And that is that he has made the world to run according to his standards, his commandments. If we insist in living our lives against his commandments, against his will, then we will keep knocking up against the way things are. And that it isn't God being malicious or awkward. It is of the nature of the universe. It's rather as though you bought a complicated piece of equipment, a washing machine, say, and having bought it and paid for it, you didn't even bother reading the maker's instructions. It's a weakness of my wife's not to read the instructions, actually. She recently spent a day trying to stick up edging on wallpaper with the strongest possible paste. And when I got home and picked up the instructions, I say wisely, I pointed out to her that it was sticky back plastic and you actually tore it off and it stuck on quite easily. If you buy a washing machine and disregard the maker's instructions, you're entitled to because you've bought it, you've paid good money for it. You know, and if you prefer to put turpentine in where it says washing powder, that's up to you, it's your washing machine. But don't expect it to work because you're operating it, as it were, against the way it is made. And if you do that, you can't blame Hoover, can you? I mean, you know, they've made a perfectly good washing machine. There's the instructions. Run it according to the instructions, and it'll work. And yet people can persist in blaming God, having lived their lives as though he wasn't there, having lived their lives against his commandments. They then complain when things go wrong. They are putting themselves up against the way things are. And I think that's what lies behind this doctrine of inevitable retribution. Live your life wisely in accordance with God's commandments, and you're living along the grain of the universe. Live your life against it, and you're cutting across the grain of life, and you will inevitably run into the most serious troubles of all, which concern our relationship with God. The wise one works hard, of course. We would have expected that. He accepts the commandments. The wise in heart accepts commands. He avoids deceit, and conversely, he speaks the truth. He shows love. Love covers over all wrongs. And he shows discernment. Wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning. He actually sees. To discern something is to actually see the real truth of it. And what is his secret? If the secret of the fool is no God, then the secret of the wise is God. And so you have the verse that's the key verse of the whole of Proverbs, right at the start, chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You can't even begin to be wise if you don't believe in God and respect him. That's the beginning of wisdom. Everything else follows on from that. And it's a saying, as you know, that occurs many times in the Bible, in other books of the Bible as well. It was a great text of Judaism. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The wise person has begun by putting his trust in God, by reverencing him, by obeying him. The Lord himself is the beginning of wisdom. Without that, the clever are fools. All of this runs like a thread through the Old Testament. Wisdom was a great quality, greatly respected. Think of the wisdom of Solomon and how much that was respected. Though, as somebody once said to me, anybody who had 700 wives and 300 concubines, or was it the other way around, can't have been all wise. But wisdom is greatly respected in the Psalms, in this wisdom literature, until wisdom almost becomes a picture of God himself. Wisdom is personified. What shall wisdom say? And in the period in between the Old Testament and the New Testament in Judaism, wisdom was a name for God. And when Jesus came, we have that remarkable picture of God's wisdom walking this earth. I think that's the meaning of the prologue to John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word. Now wisdom is walking this planet, the streets of Galilee and Judea. Wisdom is here among us. And so you have those very bold and daring words of St. Paul in the first letter to Corinthians, where he speaks of Jesus in terms that the Old Testament would only have applied to God himself. Christ, the power of God, and Christ, the wisdom of God. It is in Jesus that we see God's perfect wisdom. But what a strange wisdom it is. It's not, as St. Paul points out to the Corinthians, the wisdom of this world at all. In this world's wisdom, you try to get into a position of power, and then you use it to achieve things. Jesus put himself in a position of weakness on the cross, of self-sacrifice, and then achieved more than all of them. And so the cross, says St. Paul, is folly to the Gentiles, a scandal to the Jews. But to those of us who are being saved, it's Christ, the power of God, and Christ, the wisdom of God. The cross is truth in a way that unaided human beings simply can't understand. But like that wisdom I was speaking of, it's wisdom along the grain of the universe. It's along the line of how things are. Because when you look at the world, doesn't it look like a world where evil seems to triumph? Good and beauty is so often crushed and broken, where many people suffer. And yet a world in which, out of all that, God by his mystery is constantly bringing good, bringing salvation, bringing wholeness, bringing joy. So that Christ, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despised its shame. God stands human wisdom on its head in Jesus, in this carpenter from Nazareth, in this wandering rabbi, in this suffering servant, in this dying Messiah. God stands truth on its head and says, but that is what it's really like. And only by believing in him, only by putting your trust in his cross, receiving the benefits of his sacrifice, will you really be wise. Accept my new perspective. Do you remember what St. Paul said to Timothy? He commended him. 2 Timothy 3:15. He commended him that from his childhood he'd known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Jesus Christ. The Scriptures don't actually give you salvation. We aren't saved by the Bible. What they do is they wise you up. They make you wise so that you can see. You can see the need for salvation. So that you can see what salvation is. And what is that salvation? It's faith in Jesus Christ. So Jesus, the wisdom of God, is available to us. Wisdom is found in putting our trust in this one, Jesus, who personifies the wisdom of God. Wisdom is found in being wise enough to seek God's salvation. Wisdom is obeying God, obeying the gospel. Wisdom, wisdom, in the last analysis, is Jesus. the power of God and the wisdom of God. Therefore, choose wisdom. Do we want the world's clever folly or God's strange wisdom? And every day we make that choice. Let's pray. God our Father, we want to lay before you tonight our human wisdom, which is often folly. And we want to receive at your hands your divine wisdom in your Son. Open our eyes and our minds and our hearts to your truth. Make us really wise, for Jesus' sake. Amen.